Caught Offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
International Week. That's what's up.
Here we go.
Yeah.
The Nations League.
Which I've still just about decoded.
Yeah, no, I'm obviously way more interested in the U.S. men's national team and what they'll be doing. But that is a podcast for a different day, which is tomorrow, depending on when you're listening to this, because we have two pods out this week, the one obviously that you're listening to now, and another one where Jeff Carlisle will join us, where we get into several things on the U.S. men's national team side, as well as MLS as they head into their final weeks of the regular season. So that is all elsewhere.
But tonight is Beers with Burley later on.
Yes, we will speak with Craig, the Burl Man, as some refer to him.
No, just you. And you've tried to impose Mel Beasy, all sorts of different things.
Zeus Dog worked.
Zeus Dog worked. That got traction, even with Zeus Dog himself. We had a listener approach Graham Zusi and say Zeus Dog. But generally, your attempts to tap into the kids' culture never work.
My goal with Zeus Dog was to have him on the show, but only conduct our interview with him through barking.
Yeah, it was going to be kind of avant-garde.
Yeah, like modern art, yeah.
Oh, don't mention modern art, because there's going to be some eyes rolling later when I make a delicious analogy.
Oh, I'm intrigued.
You're going to hate it, because it's art.
So?
But I'm pretty pretentious with it. So. Oh,
well, I don't doubt that.
I almost asked you to play jazz flute in the background for it, but I won't.
You mean like me personally, or me like find some audio of a guy who knows how to play jazz?
I may
with me, it might have been a train wreck.
I may ask you to get jazz sax.
Well, it's too late now. The show has started and I don't have it. But this is going to be a fun show because there was a lot over the weekend, I thought, in the Premier League to digest. Obviously, we'll talk about some of it with Craig, but that's also why you and I are here, to give our thoughts on it as well. And let's start with, I guess it was being dubbed as the game of the season. I don't know if it lived up to it, but I can at least say that this moment was pretty exciting.
Manchester City's record signing.
Well, he has missed a few.
Mahrez for Manchester City, left footed, and he skied it! That almost went into the second deck of the Anfield Road stand.
Oh, Riyad Mahrez steps up to the spot, and it just went horribly wrong.
Now, high, wide, and handsome.
It was almost Jason Puncheon-esque. Now, for a game that...
Which was worse? Puncheon's?
Puncheon's is one of the worst I've ever seen.
That was Puncheon's 13-14 season at Spurs.
At White Hart Lane, it was so bad. I will say this, for a game that lacked, I think, a lot of the drama that we were kind of hoping it would deliver on, it did at least give us one, stand up out of your seat and yell instinctively moment in Mahrez skying that penalty.
Thin gruel, though. It was a poor game because, well, I'll tell you why it was particularly poor for me. I had been out watching the UFC fight the night before, and I'd had a few beers. Not many, but enough to be a little bit hungover. And you know your irritation levels rise? It's so hard to watch a game that frustrating with a bit of a hangover.
There was one point, I'm almost ashamed to say this, because the purists... I can already feel them and their disgust.
Marching confidently towards your timeline.
The purists will tell me that, but the defending, and we'll talk about that because there's something to be said for it. But I'll say this, for what I was hoping to see going into that game, the two most, I would say, attack-minded teams in the league with the most lethal, three-man fronts in the league, for what I was hoping to see, I didn't get it. And at one point, I looked at Amanda, who wasn't paying any attention, but I needed to say something to somebody, and I just looked at her. I said, "This game sucks." And she said, "Oh, what?" I said, "This."
No, she didn't say what.
She said what?
She didn't. She replied, she said, "Well, Man City are being cautious, and Liverpool have just played a centre-back in the fullback position because they're worried about getting attacked on the flanks like they've been exposed in the last 2 weeks. That's what she said.
Well, that's the thing. And that's why the purists do have a certain leg to stand on here, because there is more to soccer than just, you know, blindly rushing back and forth up and down field one attack after another. There was a little bit of a chess game right now between two of the best managers in the league. And I do think there is some appreciation to take in that.
Well, there's also learning curves. What would we have thought of Pep Guardiola if it played out exactly the way the same fixture played out this time last year? We would think he is not the tactical genius that a lot of people think he is. This was the paraphrasing from The Guardian, which will help you. This is what Geis basically said. Pep Guardiola said his game plan was to control possession and avoid losing the ball in areas where Liverpool could counterattack through Mohamed Salah, Firmino and Sadio Mane. While City succeeded, Van Dijk believes the champions' tactics demonstrated their concern for the threat posed by Liverpool, which is absolutely true. And it all came down to don't do what happened last year, which was concede 3 goals in 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. Remember, we talked at length on this podcast. Pep said, you got to be more relaxed. You go 1 goal down, it's not the end of the world. So he mitigated that by making sure there were no turnovers. The best almost assist maker for Liverpool last season was their ability to turn the ball over.
Right, play on the counter.
So don't, well, not even that, not the counter. Even City
loot. Oh, just press high?
Press high, City lost it in crucial areas, right. If you think back to that game. So if City are going to stop Liverpool doing that, and Liverpool's front three is not quite firing, then you're going to have that kind of stalemate.
But here's the thing that I was thinking about watching when I was watching that game. I felt like it was two teams that kind of do a lot of the same things. Liverpool would press high, maybe force a turnover, but then, you know, City defended it well. Then the same thing would happen at the other end. City would press high, force a turnover. I felt like it was almost like that scene in Arrested Development when George Bluth is fighting his twin, Oscar Bluth, and they basically are sharing a brain because they're identical twins, and they continue to block all of each other's moves without even really thinking about it. Like, I felt like that was almost what I was watching. Two clones of one another kind of trying to battle back and forth, but it was like each one was a step ahead of the other.
The term was they nullified each other.
Yes.
And but look at some of the things that Klopp did. Like playing Gomez in that fullback position was a nod to the fact that we were getting exposed a little bit down the flanks. But at the same time, he left Robertson in on the other side. So you had Robertson getting forward somewhat, Gomez not doing so much. And that kind of balanced it out as well in terms of, well, I mean, this isn't Liverpool at full pelt. And also, it didn't give City any, if you're going to play like that, it didn't give City any chances, any channels to get into, really, except the one time that they did, which ended up being the penalty. And Virgil van Dijk said it was a mistake on his part. It absolutely was. From that angle, you don't go diving in like that.
That was one of the only things that disappointed me. You know, I'm a big Leroy Sané fan. I enjoy his game. I think he's a great player. I don't know why he didn't start. I mean, you know, he got off to this weird start to the season. His relationship with Pep, I don't really know the state of that relationship right now. You hear things about like what he's like in training, both from the German perspective and from the Man City perspective. But, you know, it's your biggest game of the year so far. He's coming in his last 3 games with a goal and 2 assists. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of feel like, give me your best 11.
But we just said he wanted to keep possession more than usual.
But you're telling me that Liverpool have problems dealing with the channels, right, and that's where Leroy Sané can hurt them. So.
Well, 100%. But it was a percentages game. What do I want to do more of? And Sané, one of the things you love about him, if I may tell you what you think,
okay,
for a second, is that you love the way he'll go past players. Yeah. Now, with that, he's an old-fashioned winger in many respects. He would slot into any team in the 1980s in England, running up and down the wings and tricky wing play. But the problem with that is the more take-ons you have, the more likely someone is to give the ball away. And I think he's more effective from a little bit wider of a position. So he went with Sterling and he went with Mahrez. And I feel as if he's coached Sterling to not just be the tricky, fast winger who's going to take people on all the time. His ball retention is much better now at Manchester City than it was at Liverpool. So he just looked at the two options and he said, I think I'm going to achieve keeping the ball better with a Sterling than I am with a Sané.
Before we move off this, I guess we do need to talk about the penalty decision and the decision of who to take it. It seemed to me, I know conflicting things have come out in the media over the past 24 hours or so. It seemed to me that this was a direction that came in from the sideline. It looked like NBC had an angle that showed Benjamin Mendy rushing in to tell both Jesus and Mahrez. No, no, no. It's Mahrez who's supposed to take it. I assume it's not Mendy making that decision. I assumed it was him bringing Pep's word onto the field. Look, Pep said afterwards he was not aware of the fact that Mahrez had missed 5 of his last 8 penalties.
For a details guy like that is a bit shocking.
I'm sorry. Like, if this isn't Pep Guardiola, if this is, you know, some other random manager of like a mid-table team, we are killing him for that. I
it's
guess
like the Benteke situation earlier on
with Milivojevic.
Yeah.
But like, yeah.
Do you think? Can I ask you this? Do you think Pep was trying to settle? Like, he wants Mahrez to settle into this team a little bit more, and maybe giving him the penalty and assuming the responsibility of what could be the winning goal was some kind of Pep way of doing that.
Is that the time to be doing it? We're talking about a game. Yes, you know, I know it's October, but in a season where you don't expect Liverpool and Manchester City to lose many games, a game in October where they're playing one another and you can get 3 points at Anfield, that could decide the race come the end of the season. We might be looking back on that moment. Is that the time to really like say, you know what, I want this guy to feel at home here? No, win the game.
Okay.
Pick the guy who you think will score the goal.
Well, look, I've told you already about this when we were discussing it. I think there were so many better options to take that penalty throughout the team rather than Riyad Mahrez, who was only just in the door at the club. I would have let Gabriel Jesus go ahead and take it.
Yeah, agreed. Look, hindsight is what it is, but he's missed 5 of his last 8, 6 of his last 10. Like,
he didn't even get this close.
It was bad. It was really bad. So it ends 0-0. Who would have ever thought going into a game like that with those two teams that we'd be walking out of it 0-0? And certainly, I would not have.
And I'm happy not to talk much more about it.
Sure. And that's why we'll move on to another Manchester side in a far more dramatic game, I guess you would have to say. It's Manchester United. They win it 3-2 thanks to this.
Young with the cross.
At least temporarily, I believe the answer to that question is yes.
I would think so, because if you look at the tenor and the mood of Gary Neville's comments on the Friday night after Brighton and West Ham when he was on Sky Sports, he was raging mad and he was talking about the principles and the traditions of Manchester United and that he didn't like the way that this was being handled and the fact it was leaked. When I text you to say it looks like Jose's gone, it felt quite real, didn't it? That this was happening.
Yeah, and I was so confused as to who it was that would have leaked a report like that.
To the Mirror.
Yeah, and I still don't know what happened there. I still don't know how much truth there was to that report, if it was inevitable, and then they were forced to change course because of what appeared to be an ugly PR hit that they were going to be taking. I don't know.
I don't know either. Unless the Mirror got a phone call from a guy called Jose Gaudinho.
Yeah, that's probably.
Who called up in a desperate attempt to generate some news that he's going to get sacked, that maybe he wants out of this mess. But I don't think that was the case.
It's funny, JJ, you talk about Gary Neville's comments. Doesn't it feel like there's no one to root for here? Now, I'm not saying that I don't want Mourinho to lose his job in disgrace. But by the same token, I believe that Mourinho has like this pity party that Gary Neville and you're hearing some people throw for Mourinho also feels phony to me, because these are the same guys, not maybe Neville specifically, but like the media at large has been crushing so much of Mourinho's decisions and his man management over the course of the season. A lot of Jose's current situation has been generated by Jose himself. So
absolutely.
Like, I don't know how to feel about this. I just feel like there's like no one to root for here.
No, and look, I think Mourinho has been a great manager in the past. I love what he did at Inter in particular. Maybe not so much at Chelsea, because it meant that it was Liverpool were on the business end of some of his good performances. But the other side to what Neville said is also it's also bollocks. Let's be honest, Andrew. There's nothing in any of these major clubs to talk about when it comes to principle and tradition when you're getting rid of a manager. Where was the principle and tradition of terminating David Moyes' contract, which was a long-term contract, 7 months or 6 months into it? Where was the principle and tradition when Frank O'Farrell, who was the manager of Manchester United, while Sir Matt Busby was still hanging around after his glorious term, I did a little bit of digging. Frank O'Farrell did a documentary about his 1 year at United. Where's the principal in Matt Busby approaching Farrell's wife at a dinner and saying, I don't like the way your husband manages the team? You know, I think that's nonsense in sports when we talk about a lot of that. Where is the tradition or the principle and tradition? And even, I know Souness didn't do a great job at Liverpool, but he was turfed out as well, and he was a storied player for the team. I think we talk about these things in these kind of exalted terms, and I think Gary Neville needs to... I mean, was Louis van Gaal treated properly?
Right.
No. These exits are never handled properly by football clubs. You come to a football club and you win or you don't. That's the way it works. And the difference between Busby and Ferguson and Moyes and LVG is that the first two guys I mentioned won, the other two didn't.
Now, there's this question of Mourinho as to whether or not he's kind of just like a marked man now, if there's just a target on him, if he's being
hunted.
Well,
there's no question he's created this question.
Yeah.
And this is the pity party.
He addressed this idea of being hunted.
55 years old, and in spite of... this is the first time that I see in football a man hunting. I am 55, I am mature, I can cope with it, and I can live with it. I think clearly some of the boys, in spite of they are not the man that is hunted, I think that they are not coping well with it. And the way they start the game was absolutely panicking. Every ball that was in our box, I thought even in some moments we could even score in our own goal. And it's not easy for them.
It's like Jose Mourinho is the main character in the most dangerous game.
Manhunting.
Yeah.
Your fugitive's name is Dr. Jose Mourinho. Go get him.
Now, he does say something in there that is interesting to me about how some players are coping with it. He expounded on that a little bit more, almost talking about players giving up on him.
You mentioned your experience and you've seen all these things before, and there's been a lot of speculation about the players, whether they're playing for you, whether you're able to get them up for a game. Does that response out there today tell a different story?
You know, I think it's a ridiculous talk, because the players, they don't play for the manager. If the players play for the manager, they are not good professionals. Because one day they like the manager and they play for them, and the next day it comes a manager that they don't like and they don't play for him, but they still get the money. So I think it's a ridiculous talk. I don't think in BT you work better because you like your boss, and if a new boss comes and you don't like him, then you don't do your work professionally. It's not about that. It's not about that.
Jose is right, but he's
wrong.
It's ultra idealistic to say what he's saying there. These guys are ultimately human beings.
And simply not true, and not true to the way that he used to manage. If you listen to Lampard, John Terry, or this audio I found of Damien Duff, there was a cult of Mourinho that he could drive them on, push them, and they still wanted to play for him.
Yeah, here's Duff.
I still find it hard to criticise Jose Mourinho, and that's the hold he had over me, the hold he had over the Chelsea dressing room all them years ago. And what's changed in the last 12, 13 years, I don't know. His attention to detail as a coach was second to none, the charm, the charisma. Yeah, he screamed in everyone's face. He'd scream 2 inches from my face, but it didn't make me, you know, not love him anymore. I still adored him. I still ran as hard as ever. So maybe it's... players have changed and they can't cope with his confrontational side.
That to me is the crux of this. That the Shaws and the Pogbas, who are significantly younger, is this why he wants to buy older players, would you think? Because maybe he can treat them like that.
I can't. Don't you kind of feel like a lot of this just comes down to winning? Like, if every single thing Jose Mourinho is doing as a manager and the way he's managing people, if it was all the same, but, you know, City didn't have this incredible squad, you know, like last year, United still, they finished second to Manchester City. Like, if things were a little bit different and United won the title, but everything Jose did was the same, I don't think he would be having these issues with some of these players. But I just feel like losing sometimes... these issues just bubble to the surface a lot faster.
Well, players, they found a reason to doubt your management skills. They've found a reason to doubt whether you can deliver them to where they need to be, and they will start picking at that. And then all of a sudden they're not as willing to be shouted at 2 inches from their face. I mean, Duff says when he got shouted 2 inches, I mean, Duff won 2 Premier League medals back to back under Mourinho.
Yeah.
You know, Claudio Ranieri treated Duff like his son, but Duff didn't win anything with him. You know, so winning is the placebo for all these, or not the placebo, the actual...
It's the actual antidote.
The actual antidote for any dressing room disruption. You'll follow any guy if he's winning. The same with Materazzi, when he started crying on Mourinho's last game. We've all seen that video. And Mourinho comes back and he's crying too and they hug. Well, I'd cry too. Look what they did together.
Yeah, yeah.
So I suppose that is a part of it as well.
By the way, we like even within this one season, we've almost seen it, where the season started poorly for them and all this was going on. Then they won 3 in a row on the road and like it seemed like things were good. And then they had the draw against Wolves, which you know you would think United should be able to get 3 points.
Right.
And then like immediately everything just went back to the way it had been at the beginning of the season again.
Yeah.
That's bad.
That is bad.
And that's a sign of a weak structure within the team.
But it's a sign of no structure. Can I talk about the game a bit and introduce my highfalutin arty thoughts about this?
Uh-huh.
So you know who Jackson Pollock was?
Oh, yeah.
He was the expressionist painter from the 1950s. And Pollock's whole thing was he would put the canvas on the ground and he would throw paint at the canvas. And he would use different methods. He'd get sand and he'd run sand over the paint that was already there. And that was the performance at the weekend of Jose Mourinho, right? Jose Mourinho was Jackson Pollock. He wasn't Caravaggio, who was worried about depth and eyes and who would plan his paintings meticulously. That wasn't it. There was this panic and mad scrambling. This was like Bailey out, Mata in, and then McTominay to centre half, then McTominay out and Fellaini in, but not without Pogba being in the centre. Pollock used to say that he didn't fear making changes or destroying the painting because he wanted the painting to have a life of its own. So going 2-0 down, are you with me? You're still with me?
Oh, yeah.
Going 2-0 down gave a freedom to this United team because it didn't matter how much worse could it get, right? So the performance you saw in the second half was not because Mourinho had a plan. It's because the plan went out and he started throwing paint onto the canvas of Old Trafford.
But it all worked.
Mourinho, but yeah.
Are you saying it worked by accident?
Yes, Mourinho is a structure guy. Right, the United team starts off with the shackles on. Yet on Saturday, going down early and his mad panic gestures, you saw him on the sideline even. That got him a result and he was Pollock. He was Jose Pollock. Now, Robert Coates, who you know is the great art critic, he once derided a number of Pollock's works as this, mere unorganised explosions of random energy and therefore meaningless. He could have been talking about United on Saturday.
Huh.
So I'm not ascribing any meaning to that. This was Jackson Pollock.
Fascinating. Very, very interesting.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like it was, I'm going to throw as much at this as possible. Paul Pogba was at centre back for a few minutes. The commentators, who, as much as I like to, you know, poke fun at them every now and again, Arlo White hadn't a Scooby-Doo. What was going on? I think Mourinho is playing at centre back. And there was just silence from the other two in the box, or from, I think it was Graham Lasso. Just silence because nobody knew. Jackson Pollock.
It's like interpretive dance. Let's see. Chelsea make a pretty easy time of it at St. Mary's. A 3-0 win over Southampton. The story once again is Eden Hazard. He scores a goal, sets up another, and now he's gotten very candid. Almost surprisingly so in his future.
But kind of nice. Because I actually believe it.
Well,
it's not. My heart is with this club. I will always play for this club. But
I have quotes here.
Real Madrid are a huge club.
Yeah, I guess this was like a kind of an impromptu press conference, it seems like he gave outside of the team bus, I believe, from what I was reading here. Take a look at some of these quotes. He says, in terms of the possibility of signing a new deal with Chelsea, he says, I don't want to say yes. I'm signing a new contract, and then in the end, I don't end up signing. I want what's good for me, but I want what's good for the club because the club has given me everything. So I'll see. Sometimes in my head, I wake up in the morning and I think I want to go. Wow. Sometimes I think I want to stay. It's a hard decision. It is my future. He continues, JJ, and says, Real Madrid are the best club in the world. I don't want to lie today. It is my dream since I was a kid. I was dreaming about this club. Boy, that's honest.
It's very honest.
What I can't tell, because I don't know Eden Hazard at all, obviously. What I can't tell is this a thing that he's like in pain over? Or is this a thing where he's just like, maybe I'll wake up one day and I'll say, yeah, I'm going to go to Real Madrid. Like, does he just not, is he so laid back about it? Or is he like being torn up inside? Because I truly can't tell. From what I've read from people who do know him, I think it's the, he's not really bothered with it at all.
That he's
just
kind
like
kind of
go with the where the wind takes him.
That would speak to his personality, certainly, because let's be honest, Eden Hazard is a player who is wonderful. And he's one of my favorite players to watch right now, if not my favorite outside of the Liverpool players. And he is a guy still that will take a season off. He's a guy that, for whatever reason, will have lapse patches in his career, which suggests he's maybe a bit laissez-faire, a little bit happy-go-lucky. Now, on the other side to it is, he's also a guy that will be 28 in January. And that is definitely an age where a player like him wants to consider what he wants to do in his future. And maybe things aren't moving quickly enough at Chelsea. Maybe he wants to play at Real Madrid because this is genuinely his boyhood dream. I don't know, but all I will say is this. He doesn't seem unhappy. This statement isn't being made from his exile with the under-23s because he's refusing to play, because he's upset. I've never seen him play with such, joie de vivre since he's been at Chelsea.
JJ, he's playing for a manager now
that he loves.
Who wants to get him to be a 40-goal scorer. Like, wants to build this attack around him. Like, he's certainly in a great situation.
He seems so happy in himself. Look at that goal he took against Liverpool. That was like in the Carling Cup, excuse me, the Carabao Cup.
Oh my God,
Cup.
What year is this?
Oh my God, the Carabao Cup. Sorry, the Rumbelows Cup. That was a pure expression of joy. He seems extremely settled. And there's an article which I have yet to read. It's on my must-read list from, I believe it is, I might be Barney Roney of The Guardian, but I'm not sure.
Whatever.
It doesn't matter. It's about the joy of staying put of a player. And it's specifically about Hazard, how you can reap career benefits from saying, you know what, I'm not going to take that move. I'm happy here. I'm in a team that's competing and I'm happy at work. So maybe this is all coming together now and he's thinking it through. But generally, if he stays, he won't be that upset.
I think so highly of him as a player. Like, I do actually think that he could go to Real Madrid and it won't be like a James Rodriguez situation. Like, I think he'll go there and it'll work. I think he'll be a superstar if he were to go there. You're not convinced?
Well, no. If he finds that level of happiness that he's found right now under Sarri, by the way, that's a fluid position in Real Madrid right now. We don't know he will be entering, you know?
No, that is true as well. I'll tell you what, take a very, very quick break. We got a couple other quick ones to discuss on the other side, then Craig Burley. Do not go anywhere.
Live from the
Bremer Stadium,
The Tonight Show with
Ben
Leno. Featuring Bradford Marsalis with Kenny Kirkland. Tonight,
Ben
welcomes Ted Danson and
Johnny Welbeck
and
Mkhitaryan.
I'm Ed Hall. And now,
Ben
Leno.
How are you?
Back now on Caught Offside. That's some guest list that Bernd Leno has. So he's going to talk to Ted Danson on his talk show.
Would you watch the Bernd Leno show?
Oh, absolutely. With the guest list of Ted Danson and Danny Welbeck and Hendrik Mkhitaryan, who wouldn't?
By the way, I'm glad you're embracing the joy of these musical beds.
I know. We've got this whole new world opened up to us now.
That was good.
Yeah, you enjoyed that?
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to overshadow my Jackson Pollock piece, but there we go.
Let's see. I guess we'll use that as a reason to mention Arsenal and their destruction of Fulham, 5-1. While we're talking about Bernd Leno, this was kind of our first real look at him for Arsenal in a league fixture. I mean, what do you think? Any review of him? Is this like, is Petrček never going to get his job back? Can we tell such a thing from one game?
You can't tell anything from that one game. Yeah. All I would say was that you ask a great question about Arsenal. And it's the only question coming out of this game. I want you to ask it.
Well, they've won 9 straight across all competitions. They haven't had a winning run like that in 11 years, more than a decade. So the question that has to be asked is whether or not you believe it's real or if you believe it's fool's gold.
I can't say it's fool's gold, but I don't believe it's real yet. And I don't believe it's real from a number of angles. Arsenal were brilliant counter-attacking. They took their goal superbly. Lacazette, like we've been calling out for, when he's in that team, he is electric right now. And I like the way the team is set up, the way it's linked together. But they are still giving up a huge amount of chances. And if you want the XG sum from that game, which Michael Calley put up, powered by Opta, it's 1.4 to 1.6. The score was 5-1. But they still gave up that amount of shots, that amount of chances. And you're thinking against a team with more confidence and in form, you'd be extremely worried. Like how, I know Andre Schürrle took his goal extremely well, but Andrew, it was a misplaced pass at the full-back position. And the next thing, the whole of that defence has opened up. That is not a good sign.
Yeah. Arsenal had one of the prettiest team goals of the season in this game.
Gorgeous.
And one of the best finishes of the season as well, the Aaron Ramsey goal. And the build-up to that goal was just from beginning to end. It was great. So, you know, 9 in a row is not... I know you said you're not ready to make any declarative statement, and I get that. That's probably like the level-headed way of approaching it. But I think you have to start. We've been so used to looking at them as, like, for lack of a better term, I don't mean to offend every Arsenal fan out there, but they've kind of been a joke over the last couple years in not necessarily the way they played, but just like they became very Arsenal-y, as we said. Just like you knew where it was all headed. The Wenger cloud that was over it. So I think that we kind of just got used to looking at them as like this esteemed club, you know, and now all of a sudden here they are under this new manager and they're back to winning again.
Right. But they, even in those kind of, shall we say, barren years, even though they did have FA Cup wins, even in those barren years, they were capable of putting good runs together. Now, obviously not as good as this, as you've pointed out. But Andrew, Fulham had 21 shots. Mm-hmm. Arsenal had 9. Fulham only had 4 on target. Arsenal had 7. You see what's happening here?
You're right.
A lot of the chances, Arsenal took their chances. And by the way, the possession stats, 52% for Arsenal, 48% for Fulham. I'm just not ready to go all in on them yet.
I totally get what you're saying. You're saying the scoreline does not tell the story of the game.
No, yeah, but it's more than that. There's still certain Arsenal-y deficiencies in that back four that I'm still noting and that haven't been addressed. And I will say this, we always talk about, you know, I say we've got this lovely living room, but the kitchen's on fire. And I think the living room that's containing Lacazette, Aubameyang, the way they took those goals was fantastic. I like even the way Ramsey is integrated into that team. Mkhitaryan played very well. I'm not convinced by that backline.
I would say it's a good sign that you can win 5-1 and walk out of that game saying we did not play our best. That's probably a good thing.
Okay.
One other to get to here before Craig Burley, will stay in North London where Tottenham bounced back from their midweek disappointment against Barcelona and they get past Cardiff. It was not pretty, but I guess when you're Spurs...
And you're playing Cardiff.
It doesn't have to be. Just win. That's kind of like how we feel about Tottenham right now, because with this whole sort of like one step forward, two step back thing that they're doing, just keep finding ways to win and keep yourself in this race as long as possible, because now all of a sudden they've won 3 in a row in the league, and they are right back to being in it. This is, I'm trying to remember the exact stat that I saw, but the 18 points that they're on, I think, is the most they've ever had in the Premier League at this stage in the season, which is impressive. So,
which is in October.
Right.
That's what we have to, you know, it's to say they were ever out of it was crazy.
Your favorite player, Eric Dier, got the goal. Can't say it was a very pretty goal. It was kind of just a scuffle in front. And then it was just, oh, the ball's there and no one's near it. I'm going to smash this.
Anytime you play against a Neil Warnock team, nothing is allowed to be pretty.
Now, one thing, by the way, Cardiff had moments in this game. They very nearly scored. Toby Alderweireld had an incredible clearance off the line that would have equalized for Cardiff City. I guess the tipping point in this match was the red card that was called on Joe Rawls. I don't know what was going to happen had he stayed on. I think Spurs probably still wind up winning that game, but it became a lot more difficult for Cardiff once Rawls was sent off. Now, watching it live, I thought it was a red card. I didn't have any problem with it. To me, it was obviously incredibly cynical. Lucas Moura was bursting down the sideline on a nice move, and Rawls just kicked his knees. You know, he was trying to commit a foul, and I think he just went a little too hard with it. And Harry Kane came bursting in from Kane probably sprinted about 20 yards to confront Rawls after it happened. Mm. Now, Neil Warnock was convinced that Kane's actions led to the red card, that it was always going to be a yellow. And Kane behaving the way that he did influenced Mike Dean to give a red. Warnock said this: "I thought Mike Dean an experienced referee was going to give a yellow card from the start," he told Sky Sports. "I'll be very surprised when I speak to him if he would have given the red card without influence, because I think he was wrong. He was wrong. But when 20 players surround you, all wearing a white shirt, all big-name players, I think it influences them at times, and it would be interesting to see if he reports that." Do you believe, JJ, that is a thing that can influence an official?
Well, having watched the newly retired John Terry and Chelsea for many years, I would say yes. If it wasn't a tactic, Andrew, why would the players do it? I think with probably with younger referees and...
Well, I should say Kane did not sprint to Mike Dean asking for a red card. He sprinted to Rawls to confront him on what he thought was a dirty challenge. So now after that, there were Tottenham players standing around the ref.
That's England's Harry Kane sprinting over. I mean, referees are only human. I'd be shocked if it didn't play in a little bit.
I could see it being a tiebreaker. Now, I think Mike Dean said it wasn't just that. He was hearing from the fourth official, he was getting stuff in his headset that...
Whatever the fourth official had seen on his monitor, possibly.
But he was getting stuff through his headset he was getting help, basically.
Right,
That it was pretty egregious.
I think in certain scenarios, the actions of the players can influence the referee. I'm convinced of it.
I could see it being a tiebreaker. Yeah, yeah. If you're on the fence and you see players losing their minds, maybe. Yeah. Maybe. That makes sense. We'll talk to Craig Burley in just one sec, but...
You know what's not smart, Andrew?
No.
Job sites that overwhelm you with tons of the wrong resumes. I mean, you can imagine Ed Woodward right now up to his ears in the wrong resumes. I would even say that Louis van Gaal has sent in a resume. But you know what is smart? ZipRecruiter.com/offside. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't wait for candidates to find you. Doesn't wait for Ed Woodward. No. ZipRecruiter finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply. It just doesn't say give it gigsy till end of season. Doesn't do that. So you get qualified candidates fast. No more sorting through the wrong resumes. No more waiting for the right candidate to apply. It's no wonder, Andrew, that ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the US. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, our listeners, can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/offside. That's ZipRecruiter.com/offside. OFFSIDE. ZipRecruiter.com/offside. ZipRecruiter, Andrew, and Ed Woodward is the smartest way to hire.
All right, JJ, let's keep talking some EPL right now with one of our favorite guys to have on the show. From ESPN FC, it is Craig Burley back with us now. Craig, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm good, thank you. That's just got back from doing the FC show, just having a beer or 10. let's just say I'm on the scale of 1 to 10 beers. I'm at the 2 at the moment, so don't worry.
But that's a nice place to be at. I like that part. It's just you're feeling good about yourself now, and also you probably drink regularly after spending an hour with Dan Thomas.
Yeah, well, I didn't. But Dan's away. Dan's actually in Brazil at the moment, visiting his outlaws, or as we call them, in-laws. So it was Seb Salazar tonight, but it's very, you know, very similar. You know, he's easy to wind, very similar in size and also very easy to wind up. But I do tend to, and I don't know if it's a Scottish thing or a Celtic thing or I've just got a problem, but I do, particularly in the warmer time of year. We get home from doing the FC show from ESPN about 6:30, give or take, and I just like to wind down. And I know I shouldn't, and I know I should take care of the body a bit more and all that sort of stuff, but it's, you know, you're only here once. And I don't smoke, and I don't do anything else, so I'm... I have a beer.
Well, hey, don't stop on our account. And I want to see where this goes.
And it's definitely a Celtic thing. I can vouch for that.
What do you drink, by the way? You don't strike me as like a Bud Light, Miller Light guy. No offense to those beers. I just see you more as like a craft beer fella.
Well, I will have when I go out to some local bars, which is not very often. I'll drink. I don't know if it's an IPA, but I'll drink Lagunitas and stuff like that.
It is an IPA.
Which is quite nice, but I'll generally drink Peroni beer, or lager, whatever you want to call it. I quite like that. I've weaned myself off. Can I mention these names? Because Stevie Nicol had me on Budweiser for a while, and I was like, and I never drunk that when I moved to the States. I thought, why am I doing this? I'm doing it because he gets it cheap, because he's a cheapskate. And I thought, I've got to stop doing this. So I've got Mariner. I've got Paul Mariner, my colleague. He's on it. This is all we talk about at work, you know. about soccer. We talk about how many and what type of beers we're going to drink when we get home.
Well, Craig, I would say this, that just to make sure we're perfectly fine, we would say that those brands are wonderful, but other brands are available. And also, I'm just curious, when you were playing, what was the drink of choice then?
I've never been a spirit drinker, JJ. And it's strange because when I speak to people, if I'm at the golf course or if I'm in town, wherever, they say, "Oh, where are you from? Australia?" I say, "No." Right? Try Ireland. No, I'm not. Right, I'm Scottish. Oh, well, I thought you were Irish. No. They say, "Oh, I love whiskey." It just seems to be, oh, I went to Scotland or I went to Ireland and I was drinking whiskey. I just can't drink the stuff. I've never been able to stomach whiskey. I just don't get it. So I'm not really I never have really been a spirit drinker. I've always just kept it. I like a glass of wine, red or white. I don't mind, but I don't drink it that often now. But I just tend to stick to having a beer, which is my one vice in life, I have to say.
It's a pretty mild one. Just don't drive. That's all we ask.
No, well, that is obviously a big thing. So, I can't mention it again, but there's a very handy way of getting around these days. It's relatively cheap, and it's easily available on the touch of a phone. So, it's that time of year, mate. I'm kidding myself on because when it gets to winter and it's snowing outside, I'll still be drinking Peroni at this time of night.
Nice. Well, I'll tell you what, I kind of wish I had a few during the Liverpool City match over the weekend. Did we learn anything from that game?
Well, it was interesting because some of the quotes from Guardiola before the game, or leading up to the game, and I'm sort of paraphrasing, but I think it was along the lines of Liverpool, I don't know whether they said do frighten me or can frighten me. And I thought that was interesting, and you know, I think it was obviously a compliment to Liverpool, and particularly in the way they'd played last season towards the end, getting to the Champions League final, and disposing of Man City with relative ease. Which was a big surprise, really, the way that Man City were so open at Anfield in the 3-0 defeat. And I think that was a huge compliment to them. I listened to that and I thought, do you know what? And then I watched the game and I thought, he's been a lot more cautious here than he was before. I mean, I watched a couple of times. I know it wasn't a great game. Well, I know it wasn't a great game as in it was a humdinging 4-4 chances, but there was other aspects of the game that were tactically were quite interesting. But I watched Benjamin Mendy a couple of times go down the left hand side. He whipped a ball in the box on a couple of occasions, and it was so easily dealt with by Liverpool. Mm. They've been quite strong in that area now. But one of the reasons was there was two blue shirts in the box, and I think last season there had been five or six. There had been a flood of City players going in, and then Liverpool may have hit them on the counter. And I think it was a little backward step from Pep at the weekend. And I don't mean in a bad way. I think it was almost a compliment. And he said, we're not going to get taken to the cleaners here again at Anfield. And I think that made the game a little bit more tit for tat.
Yeah, and I suppose, in a way, Klopp did the same by playing a centre-back at full-back.
Yeah, I wonder if he tried to second-guess the City team, JJ, whether he thought Leroy Sané was going to play.
Right.
And he played Gomez out there, who's big and quick. That being said, I think Trent Alexander-Arnold is pretty quick. And I'm not sure that was the reason it's been muted. That was one of the reasons. I don't know if it is. I was actually disappointed to see, although it didn't affect Liverpool, I was disappointed to see the Gomez-Van Dijk axis split up, because I think it's been excellent for them, particularly with Gomez. And I think the more you can get a partnership going, the better. But as you know, Liverpool's weakness before has been, their Achilles heel has been their strength. The back four, the goalkeeper, the centre-half pairing have been excellent. And what has been a little disappointing, and I mean only a little by comparison to last year, is the front three quite haven't operated in the manner in which they did. And of course, Mo Salah, you know, if you think back to the Chelsea game, JJ, a couple of weeks ago, where Mo Salah had that opportunity early on, 1-1, and he went round the goalkeeper, and then it was cleared off the line. I think last year he would have taken that early and clipped it over the goalkeeper. And I think he's just a little bit more hesitant than he was last season.
So, allow me to do this then. We have a mailbag where we get listeners to send in emails, and Gabe has asked us for our thoughts on Salah. And I think his general play, his link-up play, has been okay, particularly, maybe not at the weekend, but particularly in that game you mentioned against Chelsea. Excuse me. But I was just wondering, Craig, you played with probably one of the greatest strikers of all time in Henrik Larsson. Like, did he go through those kind of patches? And if so, like, how does a striker get out of them?
No, he never went. Well, I'm saying he never. I didn't see it. What I will tell you is I would consider Mo Salah obviously more of a wide man who will cut in and score goals. Whereas, as you know, Henrik actually started as a wide player, or he played as a wide player at some points early in his career, I think in Sweden and in Holland.
Yeah,
and also for the Swedish national team. But he quickly. Certainly at Celtic, he was quickly recognised as an out-and-out striker. And I think that was the difference. Is he operated like an out-and-out striker. He fought like a striker. So that was a season-in, season-out thought process for him. Whereas last year, it just sort of happened for Mo Salah. And it was excellent, don't get me wrong. But everything fell his way. And everything he touched sort of turned to gold. And now this season, it seems he's having to think about it a bit more, like the Chelsea chances. He's thinking, yeah, I'll go around the keeper, you know, I'll take another touch, or I'll try this. And for the natural strikers and the natural finishers, and that's what Larsson was, then you really seen him give up as many chances as what we've seen Salah give up this year, purely because he was more natural at that part of his game. So there's a difference between the two. I think Salah will get his goals, JJ. I never felt he would go. Like, what was it he got last year? 40 something.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, and don't scoff at me here now, but if you look at his expected goals from Roma, which is basically a way of saying the amount of good chances he created at Roma versus the amount that he did the following season against Liverpool, it was the same. The only difference is, like what you were saying, was he was just in this streak where everything went in.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm not scoffing, because we put expected goals in our graphic now, not at ESPN, and not to say I mention it, because I don't, but it's not, some people like these things, some people don't, some people take notice. I absolutely agree, and you know, I think at the end of the day, there's only two players, really, over the last decade, obviously Messi and Ronaldo, who have absolutely obliterated everybody for a decade with 40 to 50 plus goals every year, almost guaranteed or guaranteed. When somebody like Mo Salah comes into Liverpool, a new club in the Premier League, and does it, it's like a wow factor. But let's be frank here. If a Mo Salah or a Kevin De Bruyne at Man City, or a Paul Pogba, who it's not going to happen for, but a quality midfield player who should be getting forward. If they score 20 goals a year, that's a great season for them.
Sure.
If Messi and Ronaldo score 20 goals a year, everybody wants to talk about how they're over the hill and finished. So there's a real different level of where these guys are at. He reached the peak of the mountain for him last year, and he'll never, in my opinion, he will never reach that level again. But if he gets to 20 or 25 goals a season, he's had a damn good season.
Craig, coming into the season, with respect to Chelsea and Arsenal, we heard a lot of, you know, it's going to take time for Sarri to implement his plan at Chelsea, and, you know, it's going to take time for Emery at Arsenal. Well, we look at them now, Arsenal have won 9 straight in all competitions, and Chelsea look to be a part of a title race that maybe we didn't necessarily think they'd be a part of. Are you surprised to see these teams succeeding as quickly as they are?
Well, I think Arsenal will tail off, and I like the fact that, you know, Emery needs time to do it to get in. Even if it was 5 or 6 defeats in this Arsenal run, I wouldn't be out saying, oh, Unai Emery needs to go. I mean, the guy he's had 1 transfer window, he needs time. Wenger was there a long time, and things need to change. It's easier to get your feet, you know, under the table or under the carpet, whatever it is, when you're winning games. And look, it breeds confidence. I think if you look at the actual games, though, then, you know, they've given up a lot of chances in some of these games, and things might have turned a bit different. Fulham's defence at the weekend was a shocker. But I like, he's got a plan. It's play out from the back. It's 2 holding midfielders. He tries to link up Aubameyang with Lacazette. And he knows what he wants. And so this can only be good for Arsenal. If Arsenal get in the top 4, it's been a great season, in my opinion, because they're building blocks. Chelsea's slightly different. Chelsea had a better squad. The only worry I had with Chelsea at the start of the season was the fact that Sarri came in so late. And obviously, you know, although Giroud had won a World Cup, you know, the likelihood is if Morata had started the season and found his confidence, which he hasn't, then Olivier Giroud would be coming from the bench. As it's turned out, Morata's carried on from where he was last year. So that's an issue for them. It's been somewhat superseded by the fact Eden Hazard looks happy at the moment, although there's been some stories again about Real Madrid, and I think that's a viable option for him at his age. If he stops scoring the goals and driving that team forward, that's where they could fall down, because I think Man City and Liverpool have better options for goal scoring around the field. But it is nice to see Chelsea in there. We've got 3 teams at the moment. It looks as if they could go all the way. I think in realistic terms, for me, Man City and Liverpool are the 2 teams that are going to push it all the way to the end. If Chelsea do that, then that would be an amazing job from Sarri. But I can just see them, to be honest, boys, I could just see them falling off a little bit as the season progresses. But I don't see any reason why City or Liverpool are going to fall off.
Somebody who's not in it is Manchester United. First, and look,
it's a mess, isn't it?
It is a real mess. But the weekend didn't change anything. Even though Mourinho is still installed as manager, he's not gone anywhere. But that result was more to do with Newcastle being bad rather than United figuring it out, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they've not figured it out. I mean, it was 2-0, and then there was a definite penalty where Ashley Young's arm came up from the free kick. It was missed by the officials. Probably would have made it 3-0. And then there was a header from, I think, about 5 yards in the 6-yard box that De Gea managed to save. It was a shambles, and then it was a fight back against a team that are second bottom of the league. Look, I get it, the guts and the spirit and the fighting and all that sort of nonsense. That's what players are paid to do. I don't buy any of it. The whole thing is just toxic. All the talk about Ed Woodward not being a football man and all that, I understand that. He's not a football man, he's a financier. Ed Woodward, the chief executive, was big part of the acquisition of Man United by the Glazers. So he's not going anywhere. So if there's any thought about any power struggles here, the Glazers man is Ed Woodward. He is a big part of how they make money and have made acquisitions. So if Mourinho thinks he's going to win that battle, then he's not. So clearly there is a process at Man United with Mourinho that is terminal. So it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. And I just wonder, looking at the fixtures, with all the headlines at the weekend about Mourinho was going to go no matter what happens, the club got a barrage of abuse about bad PR, even though it might have been Mourinho's people that put that out there. Look at the fixtures that are coming up, guys. The next six games or so, I might be slightly wrong here, but I looked at it yesterday. In no particular order, it's Chelsea, it's Juventus, it's Bournemouth away. I know that sounds strange, Man United, Bournemouth away, but they're playing well.
Yeah.
Then it's Manchester City, and then it might be Juventus again or another. It's another big team. It's like there's half a dozen games that could just turn the fans who are giving them a little bit of support because they're not sure who to blame. You know, because he's blaming Woodward and the fans are sort of... And the next... Maybe the United board are just sitting back. We're just going to give this guy enough rope because these next few games, if they go the way we think they're going to go, the fans are going to be calling for his head anyway. Then we'll just come in and cut him loose. And I kind of wonder if that's what their plan is, because they're going to do it at some point, and I think they're just waiting for the right moment.
Yeah, it seems that way, Craig. One final one for me on Mourinho. Trawling through everybody, ex-players' comments about him the last week as we seem to be writing his obituary, I came across something by Damien Duff on Irish TV after the Champions League game last week, the 0-0 with Valencia, where he talked about Mourinho and how even his abrasive style with players didn't make him love him any less or want to play for him any less. And he talked about, you know, Mourinho being like 2 inches from his face, screaming in his face. I'm just wondering, as a guy who played in what we would now consider, I suppose, the old school era, no disrespect, but when managers seem to do that, how prevalent was that kind of almost abusive management style?
It could be. We just saw it as the norm. Listen, you had to take that. Listen, if you deserved it, you deserved it, and if you didn't think you deserved it, you sort of fought back in a metaphorically speaking way. You know, you didn't physically fight back, but you fought back, or you accepted it and you got on with it, and you took that and you went out and you proved your manager wrong. I mean, we've all sort of had it. And I do think there is an element today of, and I've said this before, of certain players, and I think Mourinho's been, like most people here, he's washed a lot of dirty linen in public at Man United. It's not been good, but there still has been a lot of players, in my opinion, who are quite happy to hide behind the fact that he'll be sacked next week or the week after, and it's his tactics and it's all his fault, and they're happy for him to take the flak while they've underperformed. And I think that is an extra part of the frustration from his point of view, that he knows this, and so that kind of makes him, between the fact that there's a bit of a press love-in, I say press love-in, there's a media love-in of what Guardiola and Klopp are doing at the moment, how exciting it is, and he reads this. And he sees these players who have this relationship with a manager, and then he sees his players who are getting paid a lot of money and are international players, and they're not really performing, and they're walking out with the headphones on and after the game, and they're smiling and laughing, and they're getting in their big cars and they're driving off. And I think this infuriates him. And he's used to playing with players that maybe had this sort of prestige in the past, but delivered the goods for him on the field. And I think he's finding the difficulty of watching the multi-millionaire footballer who is happy to get on with his lifestyle but is not delivering for the manager. And I think it's been a big problem for him to figure it out. I personally don't, guys, have any personal gratification in watching a manager with such a great CV in many countries struggle in the manner he is. I mean, I'm not a Mourinho apologist, and I don't agree with a lot of what he's done, but I for one, don't sit back and think, oh, I'm really glad to see Mourinho struggling, because it is quite a sorry soap to watch. It's quite sad from a footballing perspective, a soccer perspective, to watch a guy who was revered and has managed and been successful in so many countries have everything washed out there in public view, and him almost, you know, self-combobulate in front of the watching world. It's not an easy watch, because I respect the man for what he's done. He's clearly one of the best managers who has walked the planet. The CV will tell you that. But boy, it is just unraveling in such public view. I think it's just completely uncomfortable for everybody. And I hope for him it ends soon. I could see him managing a national team, be it Portugal or whoever. And I just wonder if he's had enough of the day-to-day rigors of what this modern game and social media world is thrown up now. I think that's it for him.
Yeah, it does feel inevitable. Well, hey, we enjoyed this as always, Craig. Get back to enjoying the rest of your night. Are you settling in for like Yankees Red Sox now, or are you kind of on Netflix? What happens now?
No, I'll tell you what happens now. Is my wife is sitting in there watching some nonsense that, you know, our wives watch that I've really got no interest in. I'll go in the kitchen and I'll crack a beer open and I'll wander around aimlessly trying to find something to do while drinking beer. and then about an hour and a half, 2 hours later, I'll go up my bed. It's such a sad existence. that's what I do. So I watch a lot of TV in the winter, boys. We'll sit down and watch it, but she's watching some. She is actually watching some on Netflix at the moment,
yeah.
from the UK. And she's watched it before, and it's very uninteresting. Well, I just let her get on with it.
All right, well, enjoy walking in circles.
Yeah, enjoy.
Oh, and by the way, I can tell you, my greatest achievement so far in coming to the United States is I've managed to get Steve Nichol to pay money to join a private golf club near where we live. Let me tell you, this is one of the greatest feats of my life. But he's actually scooped out some money to join a private golf club near where we live here, and he is currently hiding somewhere in his house, worrying about how many rounds he's going to play and how that equates to what he's paid. But I've finally got some money out of Nichol. That's just an amazing.
Well, I guess if he's been drinking Bud for all these years, what he's saved on beer, he's been able to spend on golf.
I would imagine that fella has saved his communion money. I'd say he has his win bonus from the 1988-89 season. I would say it's all in a shoebox under his bed.
Well, I can tell you, I've got a picture today, because we played this morning, of him walking around the course, and it's a tough walk because it's very hilly. And as you know, it's a bit humid at the moment. And he's pushing the lightweight push cart, and I'm trailing behind him in the golf cart because I've prepaid for the golf cart for the whole year because I can use it unlimited times. And he's walking because he's refusing to pay for the cart.
Wait, and you won't give him a ride in yours?
You're not allowed to give him a ride because you have to actually pay to get in the cart. And I know it was in his mind when he joined. I can tell you it was in his mind when he joined that he was going to play the first hole, get out of sight, and then hitch a lift with me. But I've told him in no uncertain terms, that is not happening. You have to pay for a car, and you have to walk. So far, guys, he's walking.
Oh, that is too funny.
That is more enjoyable than any successful round of golf, just to see Nichol in that kind of discomfort. Well done, Craig.
Well, yeah, good stuff, man. I'm sure we'll catch up soon. Thanks, Craig.
All right, boys. Cheers.
Our thanks to Craig. I almost feel bad ending the interview if knowing now that he's just walking in circles aimlessly. I feel like maybe he wanted to keep talking.
How big's his house?
He's just doing laps.
Oh, here's the corridor again. You know,
is what his wife's watching that bad that he won't even try?
It's something from Home, and I'm afraid that it might be one of the soap operas from Home.
There are shows I can tell you that I had no intention of ever getting into, but you know, I'm with my wife on the couch, and she, you know, I watch a lot of sports, which she doesn't always have a huge interest in.
Hey.
So I'll watch some of her shows, and next thing I know, I'm like watching Below Deck Mediterranean, and I'm into it.
My girlfriend's done that for me too. She's introduced me to new shows. By the way, Man in the High Castle.
I haven't watched it yet, but it's back.
It's back.
See, there's so, JJ, this time of year, I was planning last weekend on just like Man in the High Castle. It's back. It's all I'm going to do. What are you going
to
do?
Why do you have to do it all in one big go?
But it's not even just that. October,
yeah.
For October and like November, for a sports fan,
That's awesome.
Like, I don't know what between soccer, obviously, and then baseball and the NFL and college football and preseason NBA games. It's like, when are you going to watch anything?
No, I agree with you.
So I don't know. I'm going to have to find some time because I can't wait. I actually went back and rewatched the last three episodes of last season to kind of like reacquaint myself. And I'm pumped, but I just don't know when.
There are some good people doing God's work on YouTube who give you those little 15-minute explainers, and you need 15 minutes with Man in the High Castle.
Yeah.
It's a complicated web.
Oh, man, what a show, though. Hey, this was fun. Our thanks to Craig. Our thanks to Jackson Pollock for creating art that inspired you to compare it to Jose Mourinho.
Our thanks to Jay Leno for creating...
Burnt Leno. And Ted Danson. Our thanks to Ted Danson and Danny Welbeck for joining us here on The Tonight Show. We've got another podcast out, Jeff Carlisle on that one, talking in depth about Michael Bradley. So for all the people who tweeted us hate for us saying that we think it's okay that he's back for the friendlies, give it a listen and see what Jeff thinks.
We've also got Mailbag, Red Cards, and Man of the Match. You're going to want to get into that podcast too.
And a lot, you know what, we also have a lot of on the other one.
You like me!
There was so much liking happening in Europe with American players.
Huge amount of you liking me.
Hey, this was fun, my friend. To you, I say...
Take you later, fun boy.
See ya.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.